This is F1 Debrief. I guess you can't fault his enthusiasm. Coming up this week, we discuss poor stewarding, qualifying tweaks, and Katy Perry.
You know how a Formula One driver, he lives and dies on his reaction times? You know when the red lights go out, five lights go out, off you go. I have to compliment you on your reaction times today, during today's build-up to the Grand Prix. Absolutely amazing reactions to the appearance of Eddie Jordan on the BBC. Mute, unmute. Incredible.
We didn't have to hear him at all.
That was the reactions. It was almost like it was like a sixth sense. I tell you, you just knew he was there. You knew he was going to say something ridiculously inane and stupid, and you just hit that mute button. Nothing could stop you.
Good week, bad week.
It's been a good week for Silverstone opening their new wing. Most people agree that it's not the best name in the world, but the building itself is very impressive. Jenson Button turned up at the opening along with Stirling Moss, John Surtees, and Valentino Rossi. Damon Hill said, "We've had people putting up palaces around the world, so it's fantastic we've got this facility now, and it's kept Britain at the forefront of motorsport around the world."
I did like Murray Walker's comment about the building. He described it as a crumpled Concorde.
That about sums it up.
A perfect description.
It's been a bad week for Felipe Massa because after the last race where he left his wheels spinning during the pit stop, they've put back the sign on the traffic light system that says brakes on.
They had this sign when they had the lollipop. The lollipop did say brakes on, and then they took it away from Massa and replaced that with the triple light system. I don't blame Massa. I blame Ferrari for this one.
They paid the price.
They did pay. Massa paid the price. Alonso didn't.
It's been a good week for Bob Constanduris as he celebrated his 500th Grand Prix this weekend.
Champagne! I'm not going to do the full 22nd thing.
A party was thrown in his honour at Virgin over the weekend and his family were flown in to surprise him. I bet there was some champagne there.
Indeed, although it wasn't all good news for the Constanduris family. I do believe his son had all his equipment nicked from outside his hotel. He was not a happy bunny on Twitter.
It's been a bad week for Williams. According to their eyewitness column, when the mechanics unpacked the boxes in Grove that had come in from Istanbul, a black and yellow snake fell onto the race bay floor. Do you know what they did?
I dread to think. What they stamped on it?
They put it outside in the car park.
They didn't let it go, though.
I don't know. I think so.
What, free?
Yeah.
But it didn't go through quarantine. Well,
if I saw a snake, I'd want it as far away from me as possible.
You don't just let it loose in your car park. Seriously, no. Not really. Really?
Qualifying.
What, no news and views?
There are a few bits that we need to talk about, but we'll scatter them through the rest.
Nothing major happened in Formula One in the past 2 weeks.
Nothing that needs its own little category.
Okay, continue.
Free practice then. Webber topped both sessions on Friday, which is good. Means Vettel not right up there. Mm-hmm. Although Vettel did get it back in free practice 3. Practice was not that interesting.
I barely saw any of it. I did catch a tiny bit on Friday morning before I went to work. Heidfeld got a hot bum. That was the only thing I noticed.
Just a big fire. That was the main story of all of free practice, really. Webber's good form lasted through qualifying because he got pole position.
Because?
Well,
his teammate was slightly crippled.
You might say.
I will say.
It's because Vettel didn't have Kurs. But Vettel himself was magnanimous enough to say, it's not
Webber's
fair to say that.
Mojo.
It's not fair to say that. Webber did.
That's what he was thinking, though. That's what we were all thinking.
Webber did better on the day. Qualifying itself was all about tyres again.
Isn't it always?
I didn't think it was as dull as last time.
I'll tell you what has happened in the past 2 weeks. Since the last show, Jarno Trulli has come out with an original concept. He concluded that qualifying is dead. Something that Stephen Roy actually wrote on Side Podcast 4 weeks before Jarno Trulli said it. So Stephen Roy has the jump on everybody in F1. He predicted that qualifying would be a waste of time. We've talked about it in the show in the past, and this week it truly was. I genuinely saw no purpose in watching that Saturday qualifying.
No, I don't think it was as dull as before, though, because there were a few things to note. Like, Heidfeld couldn't participate, even though
he had a hot bum.
His car was a bit scorched. It did look like he might get out in the first session, but he couldn't in the end. But his looking like he might meant that Ferrari used up another set of tyres.
They did panic, yes. And Mercedes, I think. It wasn't just Ferrari.
Yeah.
There was a lot of panicking going on. Not too much confidence because of the new hard tyre. There were concerns up and down the pit lane that the new tyre would caused unimaginable problems in the race. What did Lewis say in before? Was it on Friday? He said something very bad.
He branded the tyre as a disaster.
A disaster. Yeah. Now, this is the first time a driver has truly gone on the record and said, these tyres are hopeless. And given where he finished on Sunday, I don't think that he was right to say that. You know, I think it was a bit of a reactionary quote because the tyres didn't turn out to be a disaster at all.
No. Also in qualifying, it's worth noting that Kovalainen, he got through to Q2, which is always very exciting. You've been saying for ages...
I was really excited by Kovalainen.
You've been saying for ages that they should be able to be in Q2
God,
now.
They should have been up there from the first race.
They also finished ahead of the Force Indias, but Kovalainen used a set of soft tyres to do that and they kept one set back.
Qualifying is certainly one of those things. We are missing something from the television director or from the on-screen graphics or whatever, because we absolutely need to know during every single run in qualifying which tyres each car is on. Maybe it needs to be in addition to live timing, but the tyre selection, the rubber selection, is so vital to the lap time, to compare the lap times that have been put in. You just cannot know. You cannot just go, okay, well, that was a fast lap. That's good. Isn't it great that he got into 15th position? Isn't it great he beat these two cars? Because Force Indians were looking ahead to Sunday and Covey was going for glory. And you couldn't tell that at the time because the TV director hadn't picked up all three cars. And therefore, we couldn't see who had chosen what.
No, I think it's vital through the whole weekend, really. I mean, not so much in practice, but through qualifying and the race. Because in the race itself, we saw there was a moment when Button was passing cars left, right and centre because he was on a different compound.
If you're watching, I mean, if there's two cars in the pits, it's very hard to see what the second car, the car that doesn't get the focus, what tyres he's using. You're relying so much on spotters and TV commentators and things like that. We just need some form of definitive, some kind of definitive table of who's doing what when. Just to remove that confusion, because it's unnecessary, because you go, yes, Kovalainen did so well, I'm so happy with her. Actually, he's just going to get swallowed going into the first corner. You know, that's the end of it. It's not that exciting, really.
Yeah. It also seemed that Schumacher had made a bit of a crafty decision because he got through to Q3. So he was in the top 10 shootout, but he bolted on some hard tyres and went out for a lap, but he never actually set a time. And then it turns out that meant on the grid, he could choose what tyres he went on because he never set that fast time.
So you have to qualify on the tyres you set your fastest time on. But because he never put that time in
the top 10,
he got to choose.
It was a bit crafty.
That's very crafty. Has nobody done that before? I like that.
I've seen it before.
Because we've been talking in the past, our 11th is a great position to be in because you get to choose, you have complete tire choice. But obviously, 10th or 9th or whatever, however many people intend to do that in Q3, they all have that choice. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we thought it was a weird decision at the time because it allowed Maldonado ahead of him. And I'm sorry to say it, but if there's the Williams ahead of you, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
They once again, not so good. Barrichello had gearbox troubles and was down.
Couldn't get out of
Q1. That's terrible.
It also ruined Q1 because with Nick out of the action, there was no who's going to be the guy to drop out.
No.
So that excitement was taken
away
from us.
The excitement of who's going to be the guy to go forward then, because we knew Barrichello would be down there as well.
That's true. I was disappointed by Saturday. The last 10 minutes are almost entirely pointless.
I must say, though, Red Bull stayed in their cars this time. They didn't
barely
get out.
They still got out 2 minutes to go. They stayed in a bit longer. They thought about it.
As rude today.
They were less confident, I think, than before. But look at the gap that they put in. We knew that as soon as we discovered Vettel had a Kurz issue, that it was Webber's to lose, and he didn't lose it. So congratulations to him. I still don't think he's got what he had. He's lost something compared to last year. I don't think Vettel's gained that much. It's Webber who's not as confident as he was in 2010.
The race.
Hey, what's up, Side Podcast? It's Mike in New York. Just finished watching the Spanish Grand Prix. Great race. It was also great to have a race this season finally at a reasonable time for us over here on this side of the pond. It's a great weekend too. Qualifying was exciting. It was nice to see one of the back markers, see Lotus make it out of Q1, although Kovalainen really wasn't able to do much come race time. Also good to see Webber on pole and see some competition there between the Red Bulls. It was a great race, too. Great start, very exciting finish, absolutely flawless driving by Vettel and also Hamilton, and kept it very, very interesting till the very end. Great driving, too, by Heidfeld, going all the way from last to finishing eighth and saw both Saubers too finish in the points at 9 and 10. So very exciting race. Really looking forward to the next one. Thanks. Bye.
Excellent voicemail from Mike. Rounded up his thoughts nicely. He mentioned there was a great start from everyone. Another clean start.
This is getting ridiculous. They're all looking too good.
Alonso had a major start. He was fourth on the grid and he jumped straight up into the lead.
You'd have put money on that being a jump start. That was incredible.
Well, he has form of doing that. But
no, it was fine. It was an absolutely clean start. He just got it hooked up absolutely correctly. Actually, just diving back to qualifying, I do believe after qualifying, Alonso said he couldn't do that lap again if he tried. It was just like the perfect qualifying lap to put him in that position. And he was so close to being third too.
He was very happy on the radio afterwards, wasn't he?
And he certainly
weeping like he'd got pole.
Yes, because he just knew he put in an absolutely spectacular lap. Pulled himself into fourth, which is the first time he's managed that in the Ferrari this year. And then made a stunning start, which really put a smile on every Spanish fan's face, didn't it?
It was,
what a cheer.
It was brilliant while it lasted. I think we had some TED news, was it after the race or during a race? I'm not sure, that said that Ferraris tend to struggle. They're really good when they've got lots of fuel in the car, but then they struggle when it's lower fuel.
So they're
fuel.
Faster at the beginning, which is almost exactly the opposite of what they were last year.
It seems the opposite of what you would expect as well. That seems a very odd situation to be in.
Well, I guess as the other cars get lighter, the balance gets better, whereas Ferrari needs a lot of weight to get the balance and the distribution right. They've got some issues with that car they need to work out clearly, and heavier is better for them.
Whilst we're talking about Ferrari, we did get a really, really short voicemail that is worth playing right now.
Hello, Side Podcast. It's Cody from Ohio in the United States. After the race, you have to wonder, what were Ferrari thinking after they let go of Chris Dyer? He showed a lot better strategy than Pat Fry, who basically replaced him. They really need to get him back.
Hadn't considered that one. Fair point, Cody. Chris Dyer was a scapegoat, actually, for the disaster that was Alonso losing the championship in Abu Dhabi. So something had to be done.
I think they need a scapegoat for that. It just is what happened.
Yeah, but they took it badly. Mm. The whole of Ferrari, everybody in Maranello.
The whole of Italy.
Oh yeah, truly, yes. Somebody had to go and he went. Haven't really looked into Pat Fry. Have they lost it on strategy though? It's surely the problem with Ferrari is they just don't have a very fast car. Mm. I'm not quite sure what Chris Dyer would have brought to make the car faster.
They don't seem to be making great strategy calls, but at the same time, I'm not sure they're losing out completely.
They did blunder slightly in the fact that Vettel got caught Alonso on the undercut, didn't he? He went in one lap earlier than Alonso, and had Ferrari matched that, had they seen that coming, they could have lasted a bit longer. But in the end, ultimately, it was Alonso didn't have the pace to do any more than he did, and I think he ended up in the position that he belonged. In this race, an amazing start, but there was no way he was going to keep it there. I don't know whether Pat Fry can get that much blame, really. Maybe he could. Maybe we should pay more attention to that in the future.
Yeah, something to look out for, I think. So Alonso was out in the lead for a bit, but he lost that quite quickly and finished off the podium. But then that was still better than what Massa achieved, because I think his car gave out underneath him and he ended up in the gravel. I must say, when you see Massa in the gravel, you immediately think, oh, he spun it.
He did spin it, though, before, didn't he?
It wasn't really his fault.
We saw him spin the car a previous lap. It was certainly just before the car gave up, but it did look like it wasn't his fault at all. He's underperformed comparatively in the last two races, though, has he not?
But I wonder if, it must be really quite tricky. For the last couple of weeks, I mean, I did an F1 Minute that was all about Luca de Montezemolo saying how much he loved Alonso and wanted him to be part of the team forever and ever.
And
then
he is,
a couple of days later, they extend his contract till about
forever and ever and ever.
3,000 years. Mm. And Massa's just sort of there, not really doing very well. And it's all a little bit awkward.
It is. We know it's Ferrari's fault for doing that because they made the switch in whatever race it was last year when they switched Alonso and Massa, and that really did kill his momentum, as you'd expect it to. I thought he was bouncing back, but in this race, there was no positives to take from what he was doing, I don't think. In qualifying and in the race, he didn't stand up. At one point in qualifying, it looked like he was going to get, he was borderline being dropped out.
In both sessions, in all three, it looked like he wasn't
just
gonna
scraping through at the moment. And there's Alonso putting in the lap of his life, the lap that he will never be able to repeat. And the Massa's got nothing to offer.
Yeah, it is tricky. There were only three retirements from the race. Massa was one of them. There was also Kovalainen, who, as we said, he had a great qualifying performance. It didn't work out so well in the race. He went backwards pretty much straight away. Mm-hmm. And then he went sideways.
Yes, he did.
Into the tire wall.
Looks, reminded me, what was the crash he had at this circuit in the McLaren where he buried, was it the same corner? It was virtually the same corner, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We buried the car under the barriers. This time, not as severe. But this time it was his mistake, whereas last time it was a component failure. He threw it off all by himself.
He did admit that he made a mistake. And the other one was Liuzzi, who he retired in like the first, I don't know, 10 or 15 laps. Mm. And actually, we didn't know. He disappeared.
The Fact by Fact Box told me that he vanished, which is quite a trick to perform in a Formula One car.
He did seem to just vanish. He was then at the bottom of the timesheets, not carrying on anymore.
But before he vanished, my goodness, didn't Liuzzi put in a drive?
Did he?
In a HRT, he got ahead of Glock. I guess he got ahead off the start, or certainly within the first lap. And he kept it there. He outraced the Virgins. He put a HRT up there, and short of unreliability problems, he was looking good to stay where, you know, to stay there. It was a dogged fight from what I saw, and that was incredible from Liuzzi.
His car, the problem he had was gearbox or hydraulics or something. He was losing gears.
What happened to Narain? Why, Liuzzi? Why, when he's doing so well?
He was doing pretty well.
What's up, good people from Side Podcast? The Villain F1 here from Belgium. First time caller, more like sender in of MP3s. Commenting on the race, I thought it was a pretty exciting race. One of the best ones this year yet. DRS didn't have too much of an impact, which is how I like it. Might have even been a bit stronger, because we didn't really see a lot of guys get alongside. Now the race itself, some interesting strategies. The McLaren's running longer in their first two stints than the competition, but still somehow making it work. Great drive by Button, getting just absolutely mugged in the first lap down to P10, but still managing to get on the podium. A great start by Alonso. It was insane to hear the roar from the crowds here on the TV. I mean, F1 definitely does have more soul in the European races than what we've seen in the first couple races. Petrov, I don't know what happened to him, but he just kind of fell off the map. Massa should be really getting worried about his race seat. But overall, very, very enjoyable race. The best Spanish Grand Prix I've ever seen, that's for sure. And looking forward to Monaco and some more great podcasts by you guys. Thank you and peace out.
Villain F1, which is a great name.
And sender of the MP3s.
Sender of the MP3s,
that's how we like them.
First time sender of MP3s. I love that. He makes a good point. While we were talking about starts, we should have mentioned Button's terrible start.
Yes, Button could learn something from you about reaction times, yeah. I feel.
Compared to Alonso whizzing forward, he went all the way backwards to 10th.
What was it, wheel spin or something?
I don't
know.
Was
that the issue he had?
It was terrible, but somehow he made it back up into the podium. So, I mean, was that just strategy? Because he was on a different tyre to everyone else.
Well, last time he tried to pull the same trick he did last time, and somehow he failed to learn from what happened in Turkey, and he went for a three-stop strategy again. Finally, it worked out. Now, maybe that was because he learned from, you know, not being aggressive enough on his tyres when he had the chance, because he certainly put in the passes when he needed to this time.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in Turkey he was being far too conservative. So maybe he wanted to make amends and really wanted to make sure that, you know, that the theory was there. It just didn't work out in Turkey.
I think a lot more cars did make three-stop.
Mm. So it's a different race, possibly.
Yeah.
But really, the difference was, I mean, he made his life difficult, didn't he? He for no reason at all, he made life hard on himself.
You always think that if he was down to 10th at, like, the first corner and he got up to 3rd, what could he have done if he was 3rd?
Well, there is that. But the thing is, McLaren had the fastest car. It was a better raced car, I think, than the Red Bull, because Webber had no answer to... I mean, he struggled to pass Alonso, which wasn't a particularly speedy car. And I think that the McLaren was the better chassis to be in. The problem was that the DRS wasn't as effective as it was in Turkey, and we'll talk about that a bit more later. But really, you should be looking at Lewis atop the podium today. I think that, you know, Vettel did a great job of defending, but Lewis had the faster car, and that's why Button made the climb that he did, because it was just the best car to be in.
Yeah, I mean, we referenced in the qualifying section that Vettel didn't have Kurs, and he said, I think it was in the press conference, he said that his Kurs was on and off, and, you know, sometimes it was working and he was just pressing buttons, hoping for the best. And they really need to sort that out if they want to stay on top they are.
I hope they don't, because it's the
Absolutely.
Only thing, the only failing It's the only weak spot of that Red Bull. I seriously hope they can get on top of it all year. I hope it's a thing that drives them absolutely crazy, because, you know, he didn't have it in qualifying. They charged the batteries before Sunday. They've got no time to do anything between now and Monaco. So what they've got is what they've got, and it's a bit rubbish.
But whatever it is a weird problem, because it's not like it's not just not working. But halfway through the race, Vettel had radio saying, don't use it, go to this other section, and then he pressed some buttons, and then later he had radio saying, now you can go back again and use it again. So it's like it needs charging halfway through the race or something.
My guess is it's cooling, because you know what new is like with his tight packaging.
Yeah,
you know how he gives nothing, he gives no quarter when it
comes
to no
compromise with Mr. Newey.
Everything is as tight as it humanly possibly can be, and in the past he's destroyed many a Red Bull engine which couldn't cope with the cooling. Renault have had to redesign their engine over and over and over again to accommodate the Red Bull, even though it was fine in their chassis. And my guess is that the curse just gets hot. It always seems to fail halfway through qualifying and then halfway through the race. And it just gets warmer and warmer and warmer. And then they turn it off. Then they let it cool down. And the next morning it's fine again. And then it gets warm. So they've got to compromise the aero. They've got to open up the aero. Or they've got to find a way of keeping the batteries cool. Because until they do, it's not going to get any better. Maybe Webber's driving it differently. I don't know, but he didn't have any problems with Kurtz. He was okay. So maybe the fact that he's just going slightly slower than Vettel, that might be the difference. I don't know.
Hello, Side Podcast. It's Pisano. Wanted to give you my thoughts on the Barcelona race today. Slightly better than normal here. It's usually quite a boring race. I did struggle for some of it. The beginning was good, and the ending got a little bit more thrilling. But my main concern was the unsafe pit releases. Yet again, straight into the path of another car. Could easily have been an accident. I think the FIA needs to stamp down on this before somebody gets hurt. I know we've praised the stewards in the past, but I think they're doing a pretty poor job this year. Anyway, on to Monaco. Speak to you soon.
I agree with one part of that voicemail, and I disagree with the second.
Well, we did see Alonso and Webber for the first part of the race. They basically held hands every time they went into the pit lane. They came in at the same time and they were basically released at the same time. And there was one particular stop where Alonso, it looked like Alonso had been released right into the path of Webber. And you and I had a bit of an argument about that at the time.
Yes, we did have an argument. And here's what happened. You said it was unsafe release. I said it wasn't. So I backed it up. I backed up the recording, and frame by frame analysis said it was not an unsafe release.
Well, what it looks like is the Red Bull is released and goes really fast.
Yes.
And the Ferrari is released and doesn't go as fast.
That is exactly what happened. As I understand the unsafe release regulation, the car has to be, if a car is in the pit lane, e.g. not in the box, on the main section of the pit lane at a certain point near to a competitor's pit box, then you can't release the car.
Mm.
Alonso was released to go whilst Webber was still exiting his box. So he hadn't made it into the pit lane. Less than 45 degrees and putting his foot down. He was, you know, he had a bit of traction and was moving. Alonso was released, but he just didn't go anywhere as quickly.
No.
So by the time he got up to speed and his wheels, you know, by the time he got moving, he was alongside. But at that point, you can't do anything. You can't put the lollipop down, or in Ferrari's case, you can't flick the light back to red. Just because a guy's come along. I mean, it's just the way it is.
It's too late by then.
Webber was not in the pit lane when that car was released. Therefore, it wasn't an unsafe release. If Alonso, I mean, there is a grey area here. You could use this to your advantage.
Well, then because you say, well, perhaps Ferrari should take that into consideration, that their car may be a bit slower, and they will have to wait for it.
It's just down to a driver. I mean, Alonso could see in his mirrors, potentially, where Webber was. And he could, if he so desired, hold on a fraction of a second, and just the tiniest fraction of a second would make the difference. Then floor it, and then find his way blocking Webber and colliding. Now, I wouldn't suggest for 1 minute that Alonso would do that kind of thing, but he has previous. So, you know, I mean, that's the thing. You cannot mitigate for every single possible human error and all those kind of factors. It was not an unsafe release.
No, it's just difficult because we've seen it in two races in a row now. We've seen questionable releases then, even if we could argue about it all day, whether it was or it wasn't. We've seen questionable releases. We've seen cars side by side in the pit lane. And it's fine. If you've got a massive pit lane like we have seen at the moment, then you can get away with it. And it's unlikely there'll be people in the way. But then next time we're going to Monaco, and that's going to be a tight, tight pit lane. And there's going to be people everywhere. And it's going to be messy.
I don't think you can regulate everything. There's always going to be variables. I think they did okay. The stewards, in this instance, they did fine. Watching it back, I can't see any problem with it. However, I do agree with Bassano on his first point, which is Spain normally sees dull races. And thank goodness this time we didn't, because that was a great race. I personally love the beginning more than I love the end. But again, we're going to talk about DRS in a bit, so I'll get to that. But I like the start. Didn't like the end so much.
No. The other thing the stewards had to do, it was actually quite a quiet day for them, really. But the other thing they had to do was at the end, there was an announcement that they were looking into a yellow flag situation, which we hadn't heard of during the race. They just suddenly decided once it was all over.
Now, this is interesting. This is hugely interesting for me because you called.
That means it's probably boring.
No. This is interesting because you're doing the fact by fact box during the race.
I am.
Typey, type. You notice things, you make notes, you know, you're comparing things all the time. There's a lot going on in your head and you're very busy during a race.
Mostly it's just typing what I see. I don't always comprehend the information.
Fair enough, but at one point, you put the yellow flags. You said, okay, yellow flags, Kovalainen is off. And then, almost instantly, along comes Lewis Hamilton with a fast lap, turned out to be the fastest lap of the race.
There was Webber set a fastest lap, and I said, well, that's weird, because there's yellow flags. And you said, well, maybe he'd already passed it or wasn't in time to see it or whatever. And then the next lap, it was Hamilton.
Yes.
And that was quite awkward, I thought.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, it was the fastest lap of the race under waved yellows.
Yeah.
At that point, firstly, if you spotted it, I'm pretty damn sure with all the technology that the stewards have, they should have spotted it too.
At the time.
And no race control message was put up, which is bad. They did the thing, which is wait until the end of the race and then raise the point. They did it, thankfully. I think they raised it when the podium celebrations was either still in full swing or had just finished.
It was basically straight away.
It was quick, so we hadn't switched off and gone to bed.
There was time for the
BBC. So they got away with it this time. I won't need to rant again.
There was time for the BBC to say, hold on a minute, breaking news. So it must have been quite quick, but not quick enough. Well, the other thing is, it was four drivers, I think, that were accused of not lifting for the yellow flags or slowing down.
Hamilton, Webber, Alguersuari and
Button,
right.
Both McLarens were sort of in trouble, but they got away with a reprimand.
Which is rubbish.
Well,
it is.
Yeah, no, Martin Whitmarsh's excuse, or when he was asked about it.
Justification.
He said that it's a tricky situation because you can't necessarily show, because it's in a section of the track where you don't
accelerate.
Yeah, you can't show lifting off.
So because you're coasting through that section, you can't show that you slowed.
Yeah.
So why couldn't they have showed that the driver touched the brake pedal?
Yeah, there's this other thing. It's called the brake.
Yes. If you're heading straight towards an accident in your road car and you collide with the ambulance and all the medical staff who are attending the scene, you can't really say to the police officer, well, listen, I didn't lift.
I wasn't accelerating at the time.
At the time, I was, I didn't brake. But this is just, to me, it is ridiculous. They got off way too lightly. The only mitigating factor in this, I think, is that if the penalties were handed out, it wouldn't have changed the race positions.
Yeah.
So you could say that they just decided not to bother issuing that because it would have been a pointless thing. And if they did issue it, we would have been complaining that they issued a penalty that was irrelevant. So possibly they decided, actually, we'll just give them a warning. I think they all should have been penalised, because if you've got yellow flags, marshals were near the track. There was a question mark over whether it should be a safety car. I think it was the right call not to have the safety car. But if the drivers can't show that they can brake near to the scene of an accident, then you should always call a safety car.
That's the answer, isn't it?
Every time there's any yellow flags, bring out the safety car, and then they will have to slow down. That will make them slow down. If they're going to be stupid about it, that's the only way to do it.
So it's a bit like parenting or something, isn't it?
Naughty step.
If you can't show me that you can be an adult, I'm going to treat you like a child.
You will always have the safety car, however minor, and then we'll complain probably that it's fake racing and that kind of thing. But that, to me, that's wrong. It was the unsafe release, the ignoring of the unsafe release was the right decision from the stewards, but applying no penalty at all offers no dissuasion in the future from doing such a thing. And the fastest lap, you cannot argue with that. He set a fast lap. Two drivers set fast laps under yellows. Not good.
No. I mean, I think, I don't really know about Alguersuari in that, but if you are setting a fast lap and when you're supposed to be slowing down, I think that definitely needs looking at further than just saying, don't do that.
We coasted. That's the excuse. We're coasting, we're fine.
Although it is slightly good news that if McLaren can coast and get a fastest lap, that's good. Competitiveness. Woohoo.
Hello, Christine and Mr. C. It's Gavin here. Just want to give you my thoughts on the Spanish Grand Prix. I thought it was a good race. It wasn't as good as Turkey or China. However, we shouldn't have expected it to be as good as those two races, because you can't have every race being fantastic, otherwise you'd set the bar too high. It was, however, much better than any previous Spanish Grand Prix, and most of the dry races last year, I would argue. One thing I do want to mention is this weird thing about the exhaust blown diffusers. Now, to me, they're a crazy technology, and I agree that they've gone too far and probably should be pegged back, even though we've kind of always had them in some way, shape or form. I think that the idea of using fuel just to ignite fuel just to power an exhaust, it's getting kind of dangerous. And you saw with Nick Heidfeld's fire in practice, the exhaust coming out the front, it looked kind of scary. It looked like the flames were entering the cockpit. So I'm glad he's okay. And he had a good race too. But what's most interesting is this, the fact that it's been laid out there that Charlie Whiting says that they're illegal, that they'd be given three races to fix the problem. And yet he then left it open for any team not using them to protest. And nothing happened until the end of the race when we were watching afterwards, and suddenly Colin Collis turns around and says he's going to protest at the next race. Very mysteriously, didn't say how or when, he just said he was going to do it. And I kind of was a bit mystified by that, why he would do that. What does he stand to gain from it?
I must say that this story is one of those that doesn't interest me hugely, but I actually thought it was already over, because all I basically heard about it was that suddenly this diffuser thing was illegal and they were all going to have to change before Spain. And then they said, actually, no, it's fine.
I'm in so many different minds about this.
I thought it had gone away.
Yes. Before you do that, though, can we discuss Renault exhausts?
Yes.
I would like to discuss this, because I would like to claim that I predicted this would happen blinking ages ago. When the Renault debuted in testing with front-facing exhausts, I did raise the point in the comments that if the engine exploded for any reason, the exhausts are pointing towards the driver.
Yes.
I may have mentioned this in a podcast. I can't remember. It was definitely in the comments. And the argument to refute that was, well, actually, the car's travelling forwards, and therefore the airflow will push the flames backwards. It won't make any difference which way the exhaust point. The flames will always go backwards. And I said, that's fine until the car stops.
Yeah.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, that is exactly what played out in FP3, when Nick Heidfeld's car caught fire, and as he pulled to a stop, he was engulfed with flames because the flames were pushing forwards into his cockpit.
Yeah, I mean, he did say it was the biggest fire that he's had in a car.
That's because it's the first time he's been in a car with front-facing exhausts. What a coincidence. If I was him, I'd have just kept driving in the hope the flames went out, because as soon as he stopped, he was going to get covered in it. It's a nightmare. They have to stop this. You cannot have exhausts that close to a driver in any circumstances. It's completely crazy. Do you know where the fuel tank is? The fuel tank is right next to those exhausts. I know it's protected. I know it's safe. But just don't add to the problem by firing flames, a flamethrower, at the fuel tank just to see what happens. It's crazy. The poor guy had to jump for his life. Genuinely, it was so dangerous, and that car is so dangerous when it goes wrong. I don't know why people can't see it happening themselves. Why couldn't Renault look at this and go, this really isn't such a good idea, is it? I mean, it might get us some performance, but seriously, do you want to burn your driver?
I mean, it hasn't been, it helped them, or it may have helped them initially, but in recent races they haven't been as fast as before, so it's not, it clearly isn't that revolutionary that it's zooming them forward, unless they would be really far back otherwise.
Well, that's all, they could be where Williams is, I suppose. I mean, for the first time this year, I think Robert Kubica probably looked at that car and thought, well, actually, I'm in the better place.
And that links in a little bit with the diffuser thing, because there are exhaust gases going through things.
Like Katy Perry, there's hot and there's cold exhaust gases.
Is that a pop reference from you?
It is. It's all modern and stuff.
I'm impressed.
They have hot gases, and they have cold gases, which are clearly actually hot, but they're called cold, just to be confusing. It's so complicated. I understand why you think it went away. The FIA came out and said, we're not having this anymore. So the problem I have with this is, in the past, the FIA said the same thing about Michelin tyres. They said, your Michelin tyres, they bend or they move when at speed they basically change shape, and that's no good, so we're banning them from this race. By doing that and giving Michelin no time to work on their tires, they picked up the world championship and they handed it to Michael Schumacher. I am still bitter about that to this day. Because of that fact, it would be completely hypocritical to turn around and say, actually, the FIA are fine just to ban something on a whim. They can't. They shouldn't be allowed to just magically change the rules because it suits them, unless it's unsafe. And as far as I can tell, it isn't particularly unsafe. Therefore, there's no reason to just out of thin air decide that there's suddenly a problem.
It was obvious when they said, right, no, this isn't happening anymore. That's just not fair. There's no time. There was like 3 days left before they were set up.
Especially when there was a 2-week gap. It's the wrong thing to do. So I understand what they did was the wrong thing. Firstly, because they gave the teams no time. Secondly, I think the reason that it got overturned was because they've actually highlighted the wrong problem. So they, even if they said this is banned, all the teams will continue using what they've got because it didn't actually stop what the teams are doing because they didn't understand the problem. The complaint was raised by Williams, who aren't doing this, and I don't think Williams fully understand what other teams are doing either.
So right back to sort of basics then, is Williams and HRT are not doing it. They're the two cars that aren't...
Virgin may not be either.
Okay.
And given Lotus's pace, I'd be amazed if Lotus are doing it, to be honest with you. But they might do. Certainly, definitely not Williams, because they raised the complaint. Definitely not Colin Collins, because he's going to protest in Monaco.
We even have quotes from him momentarily.
Okay. Do you want to do those now? Well, tell me what he said.
No, I was going to see if I could explain the situation.
Okay, yep.
This is me talking tech. It's going to be really exciting.
It's so geeky tech as well. It's like how engines work tech.
Yeah. Well, no. Basically, the problem is that some people are putting their exhaust gases through the diffuser, and then sometimes they're adding fuel in. They're burning extra fuel for more gases.
At the start of this season, well,
we've talked about this already.
This happened in 2010. Red Bull were doing it last year. And Renault were doing it because Renault have to do it because it's their engine. So Red Bull and Renault were definitely doing this last year. It gave them an advantage in qualifying, and we talked about it. What got the stupid thing that happened, the press release that shouldn't have happened, or maybe it depends on which side of the fence you sit, but just before the start of the season, Renault put out a press release that said, we are so brilliant and our engine technology is so fantastic. We are burning, quote, burning 10% more fuel per race than we need to. Because we are retarding, because of the way we're retarding the engine during the off-throttle moments. So therefore, you have all this fuel in the tank, and you use so much to go so far, and then the rest of it you burn like an afterburner to go faster, effectively. And they were really proud of this.
Yeah.
At a time when the FIA banned refueling.
In our lovely green sport, we're burning 10% extra fuel.
Fuel prices are going through the roof, and consumers can't afford to drive at the moment. You've got the FIA banning refueling because it looks terrible on the sport. It gives the sport a terrible image. And Renault come out and say, aren't we clever for burning 10% fuel than we actually need to?
Yeah. So then...
Not smart.
They did that. The technology then crept through the field so that only a few teams aren't doing it. And now we're in a situation where those teams and presumably the FIA don't want it to happen anymore.
You can see, I completely stand by the FIA with the point that they don't want it to happen. It's crazy that we knew it was happening this time last year, I would guess. And the FIA have decided today or last week was the time to act when they've had the whole of the winter to do it. It's a crazy action. They've put themselves in a really silly situation. They didn't understand the problem. They made a knee-jerk reaction to what they perceived to be a public relations disaster. And now you're in the situation where Colin Collis could protest the whole field. However, let's not forget that Colin Collis could have protested the whole field today and didn't.
Yeah, well, he said, the only reason why we are not considering it here is because we were not really involved in any sporting decision today.
Uh-huh.
But it is clear that the other cars are illegal. We agree.
Stop. Okay. Can I just pick apart his argument here? What the hell makes Colin Collis think he's going to be part of any sporting decision in Monaco? But continue.
It's clear that the other cars are illegal. We agree absolutely with Charlie Whiting's view. And by the way, we are not the only ones who agree.
Well, no, because Williams brought the complaint.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I think that if this is not going to be stopped before Monaco, then we have no other choice than to protest.
I don't see what the difference is. I'll tell you, well, we know why Colin Collis didn't protest today, because Tony Oliuzzi raced the Virgins. Now, if Tony Oliuzzi can finish in front of the Virgins, that will bump HRT up championship order come the end of the season. Even if they don't score any points, the championship order then comes down to race position finishes.
Yeah.
So Colin Collis is racing the Virgins. If he protests all of the field bar the Williams and the Virgins, he is going to give that team so many points that he has no chance of catching them. If he and the Virgins never score a point, he and HRT have a chance of jumping them. if he hands them a bucket load of points because they end up finishing the race in third and fourth, and he finishes fifth and sixth, he will never, ever, ever catch them up this season. Therefore, Colin Collins is not going to protest anything at Monaco. That is rubbish. He's not going to do it.
Surely.
Unless, I'll tell you, the only circumstance I can think where that might happen is if both Virgins crash out or one of his cars gets in front of one of the Virgins at the end of the race. That will be the only situation when he will then be in a sporting fight.
So on a race-by-race basis, he's going to be like, nah, we won't protest it today.
But we might protest it next time, because we might do better at that track.
Surely the FIA would not be keen on just banning the field so that only three teams can race, because we've seen that before, and that is a blight on all of Formula 1.
It would be humiliating for Formula 1. It would be humiliating. But the FIA started this problem. They went into it cack-handed. They started this problem. They're not in a position to fix it. I can't see what they're going to do before Thursday in Monaco, which is when they have to make this decision. I don't know what they can do. They've made their bed, and now they're going to have to line it. I think what's going to happen is nothing's going to happen, and the teams are going to have to make whatever changes they're going to make for Canada. They've got time to do it. That's the fair thing to do. It's what they should have done in the first place. The last point to make on this actually is, I'm not entirely sure that you can argue that hot fuel or retarded ignition could be considered a movable aerodynamic device, which seems to be what the clause the FIA are trying to bring against this. That's tenuous as well. So if I was Red Bull, I'd be thinking about protesting that as well. I'd be taking that to the World Motorsport Council if that happens, because it's clearly not a movable aerodynamic device, because what moves? I don't understand.
No, but you know, it's about time something like this happened, because we were just saying how
controversy free,
how very quiet the season had been in terms of controversy. So it just took until May. That's all.
It's a shame that the FIA have to balls it up again, because they did. It's all down to them. They've had ample chance to fix this. The off season was the time to sort it out. I can't believe they didn't know it was happening. I can't believe they were that stupid. I don't know why Williams have only now protested.
Hi people, just a quick voicemail. Quick word on the DRS system. I think the reason it didn't really work was because the activation zone was too far after the last corner, so the cars were already at too high a speed. It'd be more effective had they had it at the start of the straight. Then the cars are accelerating hard with less drag, so they're getting a bigger advantage. Whereas by the end of the straight, they're already at high speed. So although they get a slight speed advantage, they're not getting an acceleration advantage to the same degree. Maybe they'll do it different next year.
The elephant in the room. The DRS.
It's not
Spain.
The elephant in the room. We've talked about it every time.
Oh, okay. It's okay, fine. But it's the big talking point. Tell me what you think of it.
Well, I did think it was a bit strange, the positioning of the DRS zone, because it was right at the first corner, which is exactly the time they get to recharge their KERS as they cross the line. So they've got all that KERS. They can basically mitigate any DRS action. I mean, we saw in the closing laps, Vettel was holding off Hamilton, and there's just no chance that he was ever going to catch him. Give him a million more laps, it was just never going to happen, because they both had equal power, basically.
If you analyse what happened in the last races, what we had was a fast car in the shape, and a fast driver in the shape of Lewis Hamilton in the McLaren, chasing a slightly slower car and slightly slower driver in Vettel and Red Bull, and being unable to pass. Now, that reminds me distinctly of Formula 1 in 2010, 2009, 2008, 2007, 2006, 2005, 2006.
That's what we've been trying to avoid.
This is the thing we're trying to fix. And, you know, faster cars unable to pass the slower car. Now, had they gone too far with DRS, it would have been too easy and Hamilton would have just flown past Vettel and there wouldn't have been too much to talk about at the end of the race. However, they did not go far enough this time. And it's such a balancing act. There's this. You have no way of predicting this. It's purely down to. I mean, there is a level of data to fall back on, but so much of it is guesswork. We know that before this race, the DRS zone was extended, and we also know that coming in Canada, there's going to be two DRS zones. Or in any race where there are two straights that follow each other, you're going to have the ability to have two DRS zones. So there is endless amounts of tweaking, but in this case, they definitely got the DRS wrong. It was not working properly, and the result of that was the guy who finished first wasn't the right guy, and that is a shame, because the guy in the slower car won the race. It wasn't even great defending; it was just driving.
The only thing that I think DRS did potentially in this situation was keep them close together.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. They would have been slightly farther apart, I suppose. But I think that in the end, the last race and the race before that were great examples of how good DRS can be. And it made a difference here, but it wasn't enough for me. And so I'm with Stephen on that one. Next year they'll do better. They got it wrong, I think, in this instance. It was a bit like Australia, really. I think that didn't work out so well there either.
It also raises an interesting argument, though, because I mean there are people who are not fans of DRS. We've heard from many of them, and obviously it was still a good race today, even if we're slightly disappointed with the results. So I mean there is the argument that we don't need the DRS, and it can all be about the tyres. Now I would hate that personally because tyres, but. Yes. You know, that if it didn't make any difference today and we still had a good race, do we need it all the time?
Well, that's a fair point. We saw today what difference the tyres make. And that's good. Hats off. We love what Pirelli have done. Kurs was only interesting because Red Bull are rubbish at it. They haven't got it sussed. If this time next year, presumably you'd hope that Red Bull would get Kurs nailed and there will be no more Kurs issues. At that point, you could almost write off Kurs. It's there because it's a good PR thing. It isn't going to improve the racing normally. So really, you're just looking at tyres making the difference. And I would like to see more than just the tyres making the difference, because sometimes Pirelli are going to get it wrong too. Sometimes, I mean, they turned up with a harder tyre. At some point, they're going to turn up with the tyre that is just not that interesting, and you can, you know, it won't make the difference. So having DRS and tyres, you're almost guaranteed to always have something.
There's always going to be something that makes a difference, even if they don't both work at the same time.
Yes.
Interesting. Now, we do need to hear a little bit more from Stephen.
It's the Paul's performance report.
I want on Paul de Resta. Satisfactory.
Which leads us nicely into our little driver of the day section.
Okay. I want you to start this one. I've had to start the last two or more.
Do you have proof of that? You can't remember.
Do you know what? I can't remember who I even gave the last driver of the day. It's either way, I just want you to tell me who your driver of the day was.
Okay, well, my driver of the day, I very seriously considered giving it to Vettel because I actually think he did a really good job. We always say, oh, you know, he's fine when he leads from the start and he doesn't never has to fight through the field or anything. And although it wasn't exactly really difficult, it wasn't, you know, a Mark Webber from the back of the grid performance, I do think he did well. But having said all that, I'm actually going to give it to Button because I think that he was stuck with a strategy that he knew didn't work the last time he tried it, which must have been quite worrying. Mm-hmm. And he did really well. He was on different tyres to everyone else, so that also would put you off a bit. But he had some good scraps. He got through the field and from a terrible start, which I don't know whether to blame him for and knock that off, the driver of the day-ness. But actually, I think he had a terrible start and he made the most of it and he got back up onto the podium, which was a good day. And he seemed quite happy about it at the end, so...
Okay.
Jensen Button for me. What about you?
I am going to go... Well, it depends. See, driver of the day, purely the man who did the best job, is going to be Nick Heidfeld. A man who got his bottom burnt on Saturday, came back. He did a Webber in a car that wasn't Webber-esque. It wasn't a podium position, but he dragged his car up to eighth ahead of his reasonably well-rated teammate, Vitaly Petrov.
Yeah.
Who didn't have a stellar weekend.
I'm regretting that International Day of Petrov now.
It's okay because, you know, Perez, I had Perez down as his driver of the year after his race debut, and he only managed to sort of redeem himself here.
He did pick up his first points, though.
Yeah,
ninth place for Perez.
Perez did well. Perez did well, so, you know, all credit to him. Nick Heidfeld did really well. For, I would actually like to give, though, my driver of the day to driver of the weekend.
Yeah.
I'm merely going to expand that slightly.
You're cheating.
Well, the thing is, you can't fault Alonso's qualifying lap. And did you see that start?
Yeah.
Did you ever expect that to happen? You know that thing that, the famous quote that Nigel Mansell says about the home crowd giving you like an extra tenth or whatever? I forget exactly what the number is. But that happened to Alonso today. He absolutely sensed those lights. He nailed that start like nobody has nailed a start on the back of one of the best qualifying runs he's ever done at his home track. He didn't put a foot wrong. He doesn't have the car right now to challenge better than he did. He out-qualified it. He out-raced it at the start. And in the end, he just didn't have the pace to make it happen. But I still think those two things make him driver of the day.
So, Alonso. Not Heidfeld.
Despite how... Well, if it has to be a driver of the day, it's Heidfeld. But if I can just bend the rules and regulations and make it driver of the weekend, it's Fernando Alonso.
I will have to protest that. And I'm taking it to the World Motorsport Council No two choices for you. It's also, actually, it's worth saying that Alonso, after the race, he did seem relatively happy. I mean, he has been known for being a bit of a grump about things, but he seemed happy that, you know, that they are best of the rest, really. But the good thing, the interesting thing to note is that Red Bull and McLaren were the top four cars, and those two teams lapped everyone else, the whole field. Just four cars on the lead lap. That's unbelievable.
I can't fault Ferrari for their lack of development potential either, because they turned up with a dodgy wing during practice, which ultimately were not allowed to run, but at least they're trying to do something about it. The front four, first four cars were in a league of their own. Webber, I fear for Webber now, I really do. This is a track that he loves, a track that he should do really well on. He was given an advantage in qualifying and he made the most of it, so fair enough, he didn't screw that up. He screwed up the start and he had nothing to give during the race, and now where now for Webber? Because I can't see him having anything to fight Vettel with. Vettel has an answer to everything Webber does.
So he's almost your disappointment of the day.
I've got a Wally of the weekend.
Ooh.
But it's not Webber.
Okay.
It's Pastor Maldonado.
Webber is your Wally of the weekend. That, I like the alliteration on that, but you're going for Maldonado.
But, well, the thing is, I got a...
Poor guy, leave him alone.
Well, I got this is the thing. You wake up Friday morning and practice on, and I have to go to work. And bleary-eyed, I eat my breakfast and I have my orange juice, and I look up at the TV and Pastor Maldonado is in the wall.
Yeah,
in
that
a cloud
happens.
Of dust. Mm. And I'm thinking, yep, that figures. And but I go to work.
He did do better in qualifying. He
really
was in
well
the top
in,
10.
He did really well in qualifying. I can't fault him for that. But then at the end of the race, he's colliding on the last lap.
Yeah, I mean, he was in the top 10 in qualifying and then fell out of the order just... gone, just
yes.
Dropped out the bottom of the race, really. And then, yeah, there were replays after Vettel took the checkered flag. There were replays showing him colliding with other cars.
That poor front wing.
But at least...
The Williams front wing must be the most harassed aero part in F1. It's been battered to death for the past 4 years from anybody who's got in a Williams, and Pastor Maldonado who's still knocking it to pieces.
I guess, you know, you can't fault his enthusiasm. And now, of course, rating the race. Now, we've had the problem so far this season that every race has been better than last and we've almost run out of scale.
Mm.
How does this race grab you?
Well, I have a question for you.
Oh, dear.
What did I rate Australia?
Seven. Seven?
This race was better than Australia, but it wasn't as good as Turkey. So I'm going to err on the side of an 8.5.
You can't do... you can't just stick in random points.
Of course I can.
Okay.
It's an indeterminate scale now.
Right.
For me, it just... Here's the thing. If we were comparing this race to all of the other Spanish Grand Prix at Barcelona ever, then it's already an 11. Already it's so far off the scale, it's just blown through that glass ceiling. The others are no more. With the exception of possibly the very, very first one ever at Barcelona, might be the only one that was even up there. Every other race here has been dull as dishwater because F1 teams test here so much. Because it's such an aero-dependent circuit, and Formula 1 aero just is broken in so many ways. This is the best Spanish Grand Prix I ever remember watching. If we were rating that, it's definitely up there. However, if we're comparing it to other races we've seen this season...
Which is what we're doing.
It's not. It's just not as good. I didn't enjoy it as much. I liked the beginning. I didn't like the end because it just reminded me of Formula 1 last year. You just know the guy isn't going to be able to pass because the aero of, you know, the aero problems that Formula 1 suffers from was still apparent here. And I hate those more than anything. So it's an 8.5.
8.5 seems reasonable. That's for you. That's better than Australia, but worse than the other three of the season so far.
Beat that.
Well, I'm not going to beat that. I'm just really not sure. I definitely didn't like this as much as Turkey. I can say that for sure. I can't really remember Australia now. It's been a long time.
I know at some point you were very confused.
The problem with this stupid scale is I'm going to have to remember each and every race to rate them, to compare
yes,
them.
You are.
I can't remember. Now, I gave Australia a 6, Malaysia 8, and China a 9. And last time I gave Turkey a 10. Well, I know it's not going to be that. I'm going to say somewhere around... Actually, 6. I'm going to go the same as Australia.
Okay. I can't argue with that at all. That seems to me to be where it was. It was a good race. Qualifying, I just want to forget now. Let's hope that Monaco can deliver. Because Monaco, not known for fantastic racing, not known for a huge amount of overtaking. Qualifying is normally essential in Monaco. So maybe that will give us something. God help us, I hope it does.
If you don't have the time to trawl through website after website looking for Formula One news, let F1 Minute do the hard work for you. F1 Minute is your regular fix. 60 seconds of headlines keeping you up to date with drivers, teams, rules, regulations, testing, races, launches, results, quotes, everything you need to know. Visit F1Minute.com for all the details and to find the latest show. We mentioned Monaco there, and I think actually this is a good point to mention this. The fact that we still haven't seen a safety car all year. Will we see one in Monaco? That's the real question, isn't it?
If there's going to be one, there's going to be one in Monaco.
I had an email from Peter who said, hi, Christine and Mr. C. Peter, the straw bale. Peter, the straw bale house building guy here. Just thought.
Straw bale house.
Yeah.
Will someone come along and huff and puff and blow it down?
I don't know.
Come on. Didn't you learn anything, Peter?
Just thought the other day, no safety cars and still the racing is great. Still, I miss the nice flashy lights and I feel sorry for Bernd Maitlander. He must have run out of Sudoku by now. So I dug into my photos from this year's Aussie GP, Thursday pit lane walk, brilliant, to reassure myself that there still is a safety car. And he attached a picture on the email of a safety car, just so we know.
Okay, put it in the show notes.
And he said, there it is, all nice and shiny. He also said, and I don't know if he wanted me to read this bit out, but it said, better not be a safety car for Spain or this email will be rendered useless.
Oh,
he's safe. There wasn't.
Yes. If it isn't Monaco, you won't see the safety car this year.
No. We also had a message from Luke via the contact form. And actually, I should mention that earlier we heard a voicemail from Villain F1. And he actually said, he left a message with the voicemail that said, it took a bit of time to find your email on the about page instead of having a contact tab.
Shut it.
I'm just saying. F1. So if anyone wants to leave us a message, cypodcast.com/about, because there's no contact page.
It's the best place for it.
So Luke said, hi, just started listening to the show this year, really enjoying it. I'm curious about your thoughts on the following slight change to qualification. Instead of starting the race in the order which drivers qualify, I think that drivers should be able to choose their starting position.
What?
Based upon the position that they qualify in. Therefore, if the driver who qualifies second actually thinks third spot on the grid is better than the second spot, due to clean or dirty track or position for turn one, then they can elect to take that spot and leave second place for somebody else to choose.
What?
Obviously, let me finish. Obviously, the top qualifier will always choose first on the grid, but at some circuits, I think that the even qualifiers in the top 10, second and fourth, etc., might swap around a bit. I think this would be a more fair approach, since there are clearly tracks where third is better than second on the grid, e.g. Turkey, and a driver should not be penalised for qualifying second instead of third.
Okay.
Now, that is a really good point, but I don't think you'll get anywhere with letting drivers choose.
If I was Luke, I'd have started with a point of, I don't think it's fair that third place can be more beneficial than second. I wonder what we can do about it. I see where he's coming from. For a second, that was slightly crazy. The problem you have is, all you're really solving there is third place, because once you get back to fifth, it really makes no difference because of the amount of movement that goes on. So all you're really saying is, second, the guy who gets second can elect to be third if he would prefer that. I guess that doesn't sound too unreasonable, but slightly confusing to follow, maybe. There's no point giving to the top 10, because there's no way the ninth person will choose to be 10th. It just won't happen.
I think that you're not going to get anywhere asking drivers to choose and decide who goes where, because it doesn't seem like, as a bunch, I don't feel like they're great at, you know, making decisions and having committee meetings and that kind of thing.
The problem is you're delaying qualifying as well. You're also, instead of finding out who's on pole at 1 o'clock, you're finding out who's on pole at five when they've had a committee meeting about it.
Yeah.
And they spoke to their engineers and they ran loads of models and all sorts of stuff based on all, you know, McLaren are going to want to send it back to Woking and they want to run a lot of computer analysis on it and stuff. The problem is it will drag everything out. There definitely is a problem.
Would be easier just to clean the grid a bit better.
That would be one solution. The other solution would be to make the grid slots farther apart. I don't know who defines, actually. That's an interesting question. Who decides how many metres each grid box is apart? And why don't you just make third farther away? If you extend them by making them twice as long, I suppose the problem is the grid. That's the ultimate length of the grid. You'd end up with cars going around a corner and wouldn't be able to see the lights and all sorts.
You'd be lapped before you started.
That's a fair point. But that would be my solution, would be to move third farther away from second, and then second has a genuine advantage. However, I'm not going with Luke. I'm not feeling Luke's solution.
Finally, this was not direct feedback to us, but something we spotted on Twitter. Chris Ratcliffe wrote a tweet saying, anyone heard Side Podcast? Sounds like a couple on the verge of a domestic while flicking through Autosport. Well produced, though. That sounds about right, to be honest.
I can't argue with that at all, except he obviously doesn't know us at all because we don't buy paper.
Not clicking through.
Yes. Or it would be more like, what would you call that?
Swiping
through Watersport. That's what we do, and in a virtual form. There is one more bit of feedback I did want to mention, and that is we got the ultimate amount of feedback between the last show and this show when I wrote a post last week about... I haven't said it yet. I wrote a post last week about Formula One photographers I wrote a post about how social media is bringing us closer to Formula One, and sometimes that's good because you get to see the inside, you know, get to see in the paddock and you get to feel like you're there and it brings you closer to the action. And then there's also this negative side to it, which is when
sometimes it
shows
you things you don't want to see.
Yeah, sometimes people inside Formula One are meaner and more nasty than you expect them to be. And I really wrote a post highlighting it, saying, isn't social media good? It has its positives and it has its negatives. And I highlighted a few problems that I had with something some F1 photographers were saying. They were picking on people, which I thought was about unnecessary. That led to one of the longest and most drawn-out comment conversations I think we've ever had. And annoyed and irritated and antagonized F1 photographers so much that a week later, whilst in the paddock in Barcelona, they were still complaining about it. I have never written a post that's annoyed anybody so much as this one on F1 Photographers. If you listen to this show and you don't tend to frequent sidepodcast.com, I encourage you to dig this one out. We'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, you want the conversation to continue, do
no,
you? I thought
just,
it was done.
I would like people to see a side of F1 they may not ever have seen. Because to me, well, clearly I thought I had a point and the photographers disagreed with me. Even if you don't feel like joining the conversation, I think it's worth reading, seeing inside the minds of some of the people who have paddock passes right now and seeing what they think. Regardless of what I think, I would like other people to see what these photographers have written. The thing with SciPodcast comments is it's set in stone. They're not going anywhere. They're never going to be removed. Everything those photographers have ever said on SciPodcast will remain there forever. And one day, they might regret it. And the thing is, there was some accusations that bloggers aren't real media. And the thing that the photographers seem to have overlooked is that today's bloggers will be tomorrow's customers. Because if you're interested in becoming a journalist and you start blogging, you start writing, a blog is a good place to do that, isn't it? If you want to one day work for Autosport, the advice I'd give anybody who wanted to do that would be to start an F1 blog. Because that's a really good way of stepping into it. And if you have photographers out there looking down their noses at bloggers and looking down their noses at people who are interested in doing what today's journalists do. And they're, you know, some of the things they said were actually quite harsh. I wonder whether that may not come back to bite them in the future.
I was just amazed at, I mean, in part of the original post was that there really is a market for F1 photos that are affordable for bloggers that cannot pay agency prices. That was part of the post, and that is a fact. I don't think anyone could dispute that. There is a market out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people were disputing it, but
yeah,
go
but
on.
Suddenly it descended into this massive argument that we didn't respect, well, you didn't, I wasn't that much part of it. You didn't respect the work they did,
which
you didn't understand photography,
which
you didn't understand the market,
which I do.
And suddenly you wanted to steal all their things and you didn't get copyright. It was it was very strange. I thought it was very, very angsty for something that had just started out as a bit of an observation that there was this market there.
There was a great point that I wanted to really highlight. One of the photographers said, listen, you don't know what I do, but I get my, I work for a company who wants F1 photographers. So I get a brief from a company like TW Steel, who obviously do a lot of marketing for Renault. They do a lot of stuff in Formula One. They pay me to take photographs. I don't care what bloggers think. I don't care what, you know, I'm working for them. I don't care what you think. And it dawned on me that actually this person was writing from the point of view that TW Steel, their employers, don't read SciPodcast comments. Now, we know for a fact that if you put any brand name in any comment anywhere within about 10 seconds,
someone's getting a Google alert about that.
Automated bots are scanning everything that's written on SciPodcast and they are sending that information off to the biggest companies. And the bigger the company, the bigger the brief, the bigger the people that these photographers work for, the more likely these employers will be reading or will have access to this information. And maybe TW Steel would read some of these comments and just think, well, next time we'll choose somebody else. Next, if that's really the way you feel, is this a photographer we want to use? So you do wonder whether it was the smartest thing to say what they said. I love that they decided to, you know, jump in and have their say. I don't agree with anything they said. I think the only person I want to give a shout out to is poor Henri Caillé.
Yes.
Who was a saviour at a point when we were looking at the comments.
Talking sense.
We would genuinely look at the comments thinking, are we completely nuts? How are these people so wrong? And Paul jumped in and he said, I started a website in 1995. And that's impressive in itself. Isn't it 1995? I mean, I don't know what you were doing on the internet in 1995, but I didn't have a website where I was uploading photographs. And he said, back then I used to give my photos away to bloggers and people writing then. And it hasn't hurt me, and I'm still in Formula One. And he talks a lot of sense, so I have a huge amount of respect for Paul. We're going to buy some pictures. We're going to give him some money because he's got his head screwed on. He may be the only photographer in Formula One who has his head screwed on.
Well, that's not fair because it's only a sample came and as they say, wasted their time on our website. Yes. So.
Well, thanks for wasting your time on our website. We do appreciate you.
We got a great insight.
We learned a lot. It turns out that social media isn't the only way you can find out the nasty underside of Formula One. I don't envy anybody who works in the paddock, to be honest with you, after reading those. If that's what it's like, you're welcome to it. I'm staying at home.
If you're interested in reading the post, you'll find it at the show notes, onsidepodcast.com. Mm-hmm. If you want to leave us a voicemail, which you can because we love them, you can call 0121-288-7225.
We've got some great voicemails today. Yeah, really appreciate it.
And I really like, we like all voicemails, long, short, whatever, but the ones that are just 35 seconds, just what is it on the top of your head? Say it out loud and that's it. I love it.
That's great. Think of it as a voicemail like a text. It's like, I've just got something really quick to say. Put it in your speed dial, put 0121-288-7225 into your contacts. Just so if you have a thought about Formula One, just press that button, just say it, and it'll magically appear on the show.
If you can't tweet what you want to say, it's too long.
Exactly that. That's what we want. We want tweets as voicemails.
0121-288-7225, or you can email MP3s and the like to me at christine@sidepodcast.com. You can also email your words there. And, of course, the contact form, which is on sidepodcast.com/about.
Housekeeping.
When you haven't been busy arguing with photographers, you've actually been doing some good stuff on F1 Minute, haven't you?
It's been fun, but that's been a long time coming. We started redeveloping F1Minute.com in December of last year. I think we finally just about nailed it. We've got the designs working. We have new icons. We have a new logo. We have a new homepage.
It looks really good.
It does look good. If you browse in iTunes, I think it looks much better than the old one, which was looking rather... It's been looking dated for a year.
Yeah, and if you go to f1minute.com, there are new typefaces. Mm-hmm. There's a new little clock thing in the corner.
There's a new HTML5 player. Mm-hmm. If you've got an iPad or an iPod, you can play it directly in those devices. It's not reliant on Flash, which is fantastic. It's looking good.
It's been a lot of hard work, but I think it was worth it. So well done, you.
So it came a week late due to the fact we were arguing.
You were arguing.
I was arguing, so it should have been up last week, but it's up this week. It's done now. It's out of the way. We've got to move on. We've got to revamp F1 Big Picture and Fact by Fact Box. There's all sorts of good stuff coming from us in the next couple of months. Keep it locked to Side Podcast. It's where all the cool stuff happens on the internet.
You won't have much time this week to be coding and designing and whatever it is that you do to make it look amazing.
You don't know what I do you?
I know that it looks amazing. Because Monaco is next week. It's back-to-back racing. It seems really, really harsh. Is it always back-to-back racing with Monaco? Because free practice in the Principality is on a Thursday. So
it's
they've
a tight schedule.
They've packed up from Spain this evening. And it's not as far as, say, coming from Australia. Mm. But then they have to be ready to go on Thursday. That doesn't seem very long.
The smartest cookies are going to be Red Bull if they bring their floater home, because they've already built it and they're probably sailing it there right now. They could just take the Red Bull Energy Center apart slowly, take the time. You really do need two motorhomes to do this kind of thing. That I do not envy anybody who's in the paddock right now taking apart. This must still be working now, right? They're still taking apart those motorhomes, taking apart the brand center. That must take ages. You've got to all get it loaded into trucks, put it all back up again. It's non-stop. And then, like you said, it's Thursday. We're racing in Thursday. Don't forget that. If you're following any of the action, it happens on Thursday because Friday is the day off, so that all of the tourist destinations and commercial enterprises can rip off fans and punters for lots and lots of money and restaurants.
That's not why it is.
Yes, it is.
Don't be so cynical.
That's exactly why it is. It's so they can get as much money as they can for as much stuff. Just the way it is. It's the way Formula One works.
But I think Monaco is going to be a real... it's going to be a key event in the year. It's really going to prove one way or the other, I think, what...
It depends. If you're talking about the World Championship, I think Vettel's proved one way or another that it's his.
I think it's going to prove one way or the other whether the rules can overcome anything.
Right, okay.
And B, whether Monaco is just... really is too old for the calendar now.
Yes, DRS is going to be fun there. And if DRS doesn't work there, then it's time to get rid of Monaco.